Well, tonight is one of those makings of those coast-to-coast programs that you want to record and listen to for the rest of your life. Because in a moment, there's going to be an individual joining us who, I think outside of Dr. J. Allen Hynek, the late Dr. Hynek, brings to us some incredible thoughts, theories about the field of ufology and about some other issues that we'll talk with him about as well. The very world-renowned Jacques Vallée joins us on Coast to Coast AM. Well, one of the most prolific, best-selling, and most quoted authors in the field of ufology, also entrepreneur, Jacques Vallée, a senior researcher at the DARPA-funded Augmentation Research Center at SRI in the beginning of the remote viewing program initiated by Dr. Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ in 1971. Given his long-standing interest in consciousness research, he became informally associated with the program, credited by the great Ingo Swann for suggesting the approach that led to the coordinate remote viewing protocol. In the mid-80s, Dr. Vallée was brought back to SRI as a consultant. He was cleared for Grill Flame, went through formal training with Ingo Swann, and his experience spans the entire life of the program and gives him a special position as an observer and commentator on the reality of remote viewing. Dr. Vallée also has been long interested, as I mentioned, in the UFO phenomenon. If you remember the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, there was a figure there by Lacombe, was his name, in the movie, Steven Spielberg's classic, playing the part of Jacques Vallée. Our privilege to introduce to you tonight Jacques Vallée. Jacques, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure to be on the program.
Oh, my gosh. I have wanted to talk with you for close to 15 years. Can you believe that? It's a long time pursuing you.
Yeah. I've stayed away from the field for many years. I've continued to do research, of course. I'm privileged to have a number of readers and associates who have formed a sort of network, and we continue to investigate cases. But I've stayed away from most of the public debate because it's turned from what was initially a scientific exploration to belief systems that are quarreling all over the place, and it's difficult to do science in that environment. And I'm still looking for the answers.
By basically backing off the field of ufology, was it frustrating for you to have to do that? Because at the time, there was no one other than you and Dr. Hynek, who, of course, is one of your mentors, both of you astronomers. You were there. I mean, wherever I went, Jacques, and heard about UFO cases and issues, it was always you. And even though you changed your theories, and we'll talk about that this hour before we get into the remote viewing with Paul Smith tonight, even though you changed some of your views on that, you were still the one that everybody went to or talked to. And the fact that you backed off all that, was that difficult for you?
Well, not really. I think in science it makes sense to go through different phases. You know, there are phases of debate and open discussion and so on, and then you have to go back. And Dr. Hynek used to quote the Chinese proverb, there is a time to fish and a time to mend your nets. And so I've been mending my nets. And what I like to do is to refrain from jumping to conclusions. And it's very tempting to jump to conclusions, especially when you have a phenomenon that's so tantalizing and so has been around so long. And it's frustrating, and it's tempting to just jump to a particular belief system. I've tried not to do that. And what I like to do is just listen to witnesses, and that's how I learn. And because they were there, and I wasn't, so I try to listen to them, and I try to help them make sense of what they've seen.
The fact that you're participating in remote viewing in a pretty big way again, you're on this program, does that mean that Jacques Vallée is coming back, or is this just a special isolated case?
I've agreed to be on to give the keynote speech at that conference on remote viewing in Las Vegas next month at the invitation of Paul, you know, Paul Smith, and Ingo Swann. I have a lot of respect for these men, and I've learned a lot from them. I consider that subject as somewhat unrelated to the UFO subject, and I certainly don't consider myself a parapsychologist. There are a number of professional people in that field who spend all their time doing experiments. I'm not one of them. I'm an interested observer. And I had the privilege of working especially with Dr. Putoff and with Ingo in the early days of the program, and I've tried to make a contribution to it.
I don't know if you ever came across some of the work of my aunt, who was very close to Ingo Swann at the time, Dr. Shafika Karegula.
Yes.
And she wrote the book Breakthrough to Creativity.
Yes.
That was my aunt. You know, life was snuffed out in her very early. I've always wondered, Jacques, what her specific field and interest would be, because she was into telepathy and she was getting into remote viewing. And I thought she was one of the greatest scientists around. Had her life not been cut short, who knows what could have happened with her.
No, remote viewing has a long history. At the turn of the century, the previous century, you know, in the early 1900s, there was a lot of research in Europe, and some research by especially a man named Var Collier in France at an institute called the Metapsychic Institute in France, which is still in existence. And he did a lot of the pioneering work. And, it's a field that has a long and distinguished history.
I'm going to bring Paul Smith in with you next hour, and he's going to stay with us for the rest of the show as we talk about remote viewing and some of the work that is going on. And we'll take just the moments tonight in this hour that will go by very fast to talk about your career, how you got going. You had... observed, I think, at an early age, did you not, a UFO case? Isn't that what got you interested in this?
Yes. In 1955, and I was 15, I was 16, actually. And my mother was working in the yard, and she saw something in the sky and called me. I rushed down the stairs to join her, and we saw an object that, you know, I can only describe as looking like a saucer. What made me take that seriously, because it could have been something seen, an airplane seen from a particular angle or a strange prototype or something. But a friend of mine who was a physics student was about a mile away up on a hill, and he told me the next day that he had seen it and he had watched it with binoculars. So that object was seen long enough for all of us to get a good look at it, and his description was absolutely consistent with ours. At the time, I sort of convinced myself, as many witnesses do, that this must be just, one of those things. And then several years later, of course, I was trained in astronomy in France, and my first job was at Paris Observatory, tracking satellites. This was in the very early days of the space program,
mm-hmm.
when there were very few satellites visible in the sky. And all of us on the team saw an object that was retrograde. In other words, it was going around the Earth in the reverse of what is the easiest trajectory for a satellite. In those days, there was no rocket powerful enough to launch a retrograde satellite around the Earth. And it was very bright. We tracked it. We got 11 data points on it. And we were excited because it could have been an asteroid that was captured by the Earth that was in orbit, and we were excited about computing an orbit. The men in charge of the project confiscated the tape and erased it. And that's really what got me to re-examine the whole thing, because I had always thought if there were UFOs, astronomers would see them and astronomers would tell us. And here we were at Paris Observatory, a team of astronomers seeing something we could not explain. And it might have been natural, but it certainly was very, very unusual. It was seen by other teams on successive nights, and we were destroying the data. And in astronomy, you never destroy the data because you may be seeing something that's not going to happen again for 200 years. And
what compelled him?
You keep the data.
What compelled him to destroy the data?
I've pondered that. I think it was not so much a cover-up as it was fear of ridicule. I told him, why didn't we send that to the Americans? In those days, under the geophysical year agreements, all scientists were pooling their data on satellites. And he said, well, the Americans would laugh at us. And I think people in this country don't realize the prestige of American science is such that if American scientists say something doesn't exist, well, it doesn't exist, and people will destroy their data because they don't want to be laughed at. Later on, of course, Dr. Hynek showed me some data that he had saved from the satellite program. Of course, he was the one who instituted the satellite tracking program for the U.S. after Sputnik. And some of the data was on the same nights of the same object we had seen.
So as you got into trying to validate the, at that time, the popular extraterrestrial views, you changed your views a little bit. We'll talk about that in a moment. But with your association with Dr. Hynek, did you know him when he was the consultant for Project Blue Book, when he was sort of like a skeptic until he changed?
When Dr. Hynek was someone of great intelligence and tremendous open mind, and he had gotten into science because he was interested in the limitations of science. He was not pompous at all. He was not one of those scientists who tried to explain everything. On the contrary, he was fascinated with mysteries. And, of course, that's what drew him to astronomy in the first place. He had to be a skeptic because he had the data he had seen from the Air Force in the early days was not strong data. It was interesting enough that he remained involved in it, but he was always waiting for the case or the proverbial proof of the phenomenon, and that did not happen. So he was always sort of skeptically reviewing the data. But he was interested enough that he traveled to France, for example, to meet Aimé Michel and Pierre Guérin, who were two of the people who had done extensive studies of the phenomenon in France. And, of course, the European data was extremely rich. And he came back very puzzled. When I met him, I joined his team at Northwestern in 1963. He was, at that point, the scientific consultant for Project Blue Book. And I showed him the European data, case after case after case. And I told him, look, the phenomenon must be the same in the U.S., except it's not recorded properly, because people are afraid of reporting certain things to the Air Force. Some of the data is being censored by some of the ufologists themselves. Many people didn't want to talk about close encounters, or what we were calling landings, and that Dr. Hynek called later close encounters. And I think that's what changed his mind.
Did that metamorphosis surprise you? And you might have been responsible for him to change.
Yes. He gave me credit for changing his mind. But what changed his mind was seeing the patterns emerge. My wife and I had done the first computer catalog of cases. It was about 3,000 cases, selected cases. And I'm an information scientist. I was trained in physics, but my career has been in information science. So I tend to look for patterns in things. one particular case doesn't really prove anything. There is a, you know, the skeptics are always saying, well, give us your best case and we'll take it apart. There is no such thing as one best case in any field. You have to look at an accumulation of cases and look for patterns, and then that's how the phenomenon reveals itself to you. And that's what we went through. Of course, the clincher was that Dr. Heine gave me access to the Air Force files, the Blue Book files, which were largely unclassified. People always talk about, you know, the secret files of Project Blue Book. Well, there were a few classified cases that I couldn't see, but most of the cases were open. And those were the ones that I was really interested in. And I was able to show him that the patterns were the same. In fact, there were more landing cases in the Air Force files than there were in the files of NICAP, which was one of the ufology groups. Because at that point, ufologists were afraid of looking silly. So they were pre-selecting data that was not too strange. And of course, you have to take, well, I believe you have to take data the way it is. And if it is strange, if it looks strange, you have to deal with it. That's true in any science. There are many strange phenomena in physics, and you can't shy away from it.
In your work, specifically Passport to Magonia, I noticed the change of people, your mindset to what are these UFOs? Are these people, are these beings extraterrestrial? You started changing. What caused that change, Doctor?
Well, in the early days, I think that's true for most of us in the field. You enter the field and with some arrogance, especially the arrogance of, you know, a young scientist, which I was at the time. And you think, well, you know, nobody has really done the research. And if I apply the tools I know, the tools of physics and computer science and so on, to this database of all these sightings, obviously these people are not lying. Obviously they've seen something extremely unusual. In a year or two, I'll be able to solve it. And so you make a list of hypotheses. This is obviously not a natural phenomenon. And the extraterrestrial explanation seemed to be the best one. Why shouldn't we know that there's got to be life throughout the universe? So why shouldn't it be able to come here? Especially since there must be civilizations there that are, you know, thousands, if not millions, of years ahead of us. So it looks like a very likely hypothesis, and it still is one of the hypotheses we have to consider. But then as you get more and more data, you realize that's not what the witnesses are describing. What the witnesses are describing is something that in many cases comes out of nowhere, disappears into nowhere. There are cases of objects becoming transparent on the spot, physical objects, material objects. And I have no question that people have said, well, Vallée doesn't believe this is physical. Well, of course it is physical. It's material at some times. But it can also change shape. It can also merge with other objects, and it can also disappear on the spot. Well, if it does that, then it could be from anywhere, anytime.
Jacques, stay with us. We'll be right back with you. We'll continue this incredible discussion with you. Also, you wrote a paper about 5 arguments against the extraterrestrial origin of unidentified flying objects. We'll talk about that as well. Fascinating. Dr. Jacques Vallée, our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Dr. Jacques Vallée. Next hour, Paul Smith, remote viewer, will join us for the rest of the program with Dr. Vallée as well. Doctor, in the book, Passport to Magonia, it is, Magonia, of course, is a magical land in French folk tales. Is that how you got the name for the book?
Yes. I was, after I wrote my first two books, and I wrote those books out of a feeling that I had the collection of data that was filtered, that was verified, and that I should make it available to other researchers. So once I had done that, I certainly felt a sense of relief that I had at least done my duty to my fellow researchers. And then I started looking at some of the things that didn't fit. And one of the things that, you know, I had to ask is, when did this actually start? Every UFO book starts with, you know, on June 24, 1947, Kenneth Arnold saw something about Ukraine and so on. Well, that's not really true. I mean, we have data from the 30s and the 20s and from 1896 and 1897 all over the United States, and then you can go back in history. And many people don't want to hear that. They want to hear that this is, you know, if you follow the first-level extraterrestrial theory, then ETs, you know, discovered us when the atom bomb went off and they came here to study us. Well, that's not what the data says. So when did it start? And I found, an enormous wealth of data going back to medieval times and even before. Of course, as you go back in history, you lose the cultural context and it's harder to understand the data. But in medieval times, there were records, especially the records of the church, that were kept very, very carefully about strange phenomena. And from those records, we've been able to find out how many comets were seen, the frequency of meteors, even other natural cycles. And the term Magonia came from the writings of the Archbishop of Lyon in the 9th century. He was writing against the superstitions of the time. He was a skeptic. And he said that one of the things that people believed around Lyon was that there was a magical land above the clouds, which is where the cloud ships came from. Well, what cloud ships? Well, those were obviously physical things that people saw coming from the sky. Not only that, but there were people coming out of those cloud ships. And he said one day the crowd in Lyon brought him four people, three men and one woman, in chains that they had captured coming out of one of those cloud ships, and they thought they were witches. So they were going to kill them. And he preached to the crowd that this could not, that they could not have come out of a cloud ship because there was no such thing. And of course, he was arguing as a theologian that witches did not have enough power to affect the weather and atmospheric phenomena, that this was something that would take away from the majesty of God. And that was his argument against the superstitions of the time and against Magonia. And I thought it was such a great story that I called my book Passport to Magonia.
Oh, wonderful. And in Messengers of Deception, another fine work by you, the change was occurring where you were shifting from what conventional ufologists believe UFOs may be and extraterrestrials into this other area where you began to tie in psychic phenomena, angels, ghosts, occults. You began to see that. What was it that really started that shift for you?
Well, it's the realization that we deal with a phenomenon that is extraordinarily complex. And again, I start from what the witnesses tell me, not from hypotheses.
Right.
The hypotheses have to come later. But, you know, these people are sincere. As you know, I've traveled all over the world. I've spoken to people on several continents, traveled all over the U.S. And I try to listen carefully to what people tell me. It's a very complex phenomenon. So if you let me, or if you let anybody select data for a particular theory, of course you can prove anything you want. The problem is we shouldn't be doing that. We should take the whole phenomenon with all its complexity. And it includes reports from people, for example, that strange phenomena have happened in connection or before or immediately after what they perceived as a UFO sighting. And that includes a change in consciousness. And, of course, by then, I was introduced to the SRI program on remote viewing, and I'd always been interested in the phenomena of consciousness and parapsychology. Mm-hmm. And that is definitely part of the overall phenomenon. So that opens a whole other layer of study of and possible hypotheses about UFOs.
The incredible movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Spielberg's movie based on Dr. Hynek's book of the same title, and all of it, but the Frenchman in the movie was based on you. And how did that happen? How was that evolution?
When I met with Mr. Spielberg, he told me that he had been thinking about that movie ever since he was a teenager. In fact, he had played with UFO imagery with a 16 millimeter camera a long time before, and he had it was amusing that he had read my books. So he thought that I think he thought it was funny that there would be a Frenchman trying to investigate UFOs in the United States, and that that it's as an alien, but not quite the same kind of alien. And he thought it would be nice to have a character based on that. So he
what did you think?
Character on me.
When you went to the, I'm sure you've seen the movie.
Oh yeah.
What did you think of basically you being that part?
Well, it wasn't so much me, but François Truffaut is somebody I've always admired. I was introduced to Mr. Spielberg by Marsha Seligson, who was a writer and journalist in Los Angeles. We had lunch a couple of times, and I tried to argue that if the aliens in the movie were not extraterrestrial, it would be even more interesting. But of course, that was not what the public expected, and it's a lot easier to think of UFOs as being strictly extraterrestrial. Again, if we listen to the witnesses, we have to open up the spectrum of hypotheses beyond that. It's only one hypothesis among many.
But you found it to be an entertaining movie?
Oh, yes.
Fun?
Oh, yes. And again, François Truffaut is tremendous in the movie. I love the part where he keeps going around trying to tell the military that this is a sociological phenomenon. And among other things, it is. And of course, the movie hinges on remote viewing.
It sure does. I had heard that you tried to convince Spielberg later to do another movie based on the fact that, this is different. This could be much more than just extraterrestrials from other planets.
Well, there is another movie waiting to be made, but it would have to be made carefully to match the complexity of the phenomenon and something that's scientifically valid. But yes, I think there is another movie to be made at some point.
Those who believe, Jacques, that we might have been seeded from extraterrestrials, regardless of where they come from, do you accept that theory, that possibility?
I'm not a biologist. I'm not a molecular biologist. We don't know where DNA came from. The components of DNA are, of course, natural elements. But those natural elements are found throughout the universe. It's possible that even that life could have appeared first on Mars. Again, it's not my own theory. It's a theory that people are seriously considering. We know that the collisions of asteroids with Mars could have ejected material that could have landed on Earth. And scientists have recovered Martian meteorites, especially in Antarctica, where it's easiest to find them. And there is still a debate about whether those meteorites may contain traces left by ancient life. So a lot of speculation is possible, a lot of hypotheses. The components of DNA or even bits of DNA itself could have come from the cosmos. That doesn't mean we were seeded by any intelligent species. It could be a natural phenomenon, but life could have first appeared outside the Earth and been projected to the Earth by meteorites.
The change in your thoughts, of course, went contrary to what the mainstream, if you can call it mainstream, ufologists would think of extraterrestrial life. Did they kind of shun you when that metamorphosis occurred?
Well, that's all right. You know, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. I think
sure.
That's the way, you know, research has to work. Similar with the skeptics, you know, the skeptics just don't want to look at the facts, and that's fine too. I think those are the same people who didn't want to believe that artificial satellites could be useful in science, same people who said computers were a waste of time. And, so, you know, those things change with time. I can understand people saying, look, if it's not terrestrial, it's got to be extraterrestrial. And that's a simple-minded approach to it. Well, it could be. It could be lots of other things. What the phenomenon is really saying is that we don't understand space and time. And that's really what's very, very interesting to me, is that it's an opportunity to learn something and to do some good physics and to look at new models in physics.
You came up with an incredible hypothesis in 1990 called Five Arguments Against the Extraterrestrial Origin of Unidentified Flying Objects. Let's just take a few moments while we have time this hour before we bring Paul Smith on. These are incredible points. I mean, you talked about unexplained close encounters are far more numerous than required for physical survey of the Earth. What do you mean of that?
Well, I didn't do a good job of explaining why I wrote that paper. People have assumed that, well, if I call the paper Five Arguments Against the Extraterrestrial Theory, it means that I don't believe in UFOs.
Right.
Of course, that's not the case at all. In science, when you have an hypothesis, you must look at the things that contradict your hypothesis. That's the first rule. You can't just lobby people to believe the same thing you believe. That's not the way science works. It would be a little bit too easy. This is not politics. This is science. So my question was, what are the things that any extraterrestrial theory has to account for to be a valid theory? And one of the there are a number of problems, you know, without going into all the details.
Sure.
First, this is not a new phenomenon. This is a phenomenon that, as far as we can tell, has been with us throughout human history. It's much more complex and diverse than a survey of the Earth by some civilization coming here. The appearance of the beings is consistent with human beings. Their appearance is somewhat different, but the witnesses say they can read emotions on their faces. These beings have two legs and two arms and one head with pretty much the same organs we do. Any biologist, and I've had extensive discussions with zoologists, and I've asked them, was it a foregone conclusion that human beings would be the dominant intelligent species on Earth? And the answer is absolutely not. The octopus could have developed into something much more intelligent than human
sure.
beings.
I think the dolphin has.
Dolphins, yeah. Birds. Some birds, the use of tools by birds is remarkable. And they did not develop into the most dominant or intelligent species. But that's probably an accident. And we don't know what's going to happen after the human race. And certainly we would not expect, and people have disagreed with me, and you know, in honest disagreement about this, but you would not expect a creature from evolution on another planet to look so similar to us. It could still be extraterrestrial, but you need to expand the assumptions you're making about it. And then there is a number, as you were saying, the sheer number of landings. We know that only one case in 10 or 20 is ever reported. And we know that if the occurrences are independent of a witness being there, which would be the case in a survey of the Earth, then we need to extrapolate for the fact that people go to bed at night and that there are no observers out there. And you reach numbers that are extraordinary. And with the technology we have now, if we were to explore a planet that had life on it, intelligent life, we could do it with something, you know, the size of a small car in orbit around that planet, and we might land a few times, but we certainly would not need to deploy the kind of technology that seems to be deployed here, if it's a technology.
And you know, their ability, their whatever propulsion system or their ability to manipulate space to get here, to me, probably points out the fact that there's something here that we really don't understand, that is way beyond the simple extraterrestrial theories that we used to listen to years ago.
And that's what really keeps me going. That's why I haven't given up on the field. I love technology. My business is high technology. I have people in my office every day teaching me new things about technology and showing me that things I thought were impossible are now achievable. And so this phenomenon is a fascinating challenge. The idea that they have to be either terrestrial or extraterrestrial reminds me of, you know, if we were sitting here in the 12th century and we're looking at planets, well, we know planets move in the sky. So what could, if something moves, it has to be pushed by something.
Right.
There are only two things that could push planets around. That's either angels or devils, right? So you would say, well, half of us would argue that they are pushed around by angels, and the other half would argue they are pushed around by demons. Well, of course, now we've learned that they don't have to be pushed by anything. And we know a lot more about physics, and we understand that the movement of the planet is perfectly natural and is governed by fairly simple laws. And we don't need either angels or demons. Well, it's the same thing here. You know, UFOs are an indication that there is something about space and time that we don't understand. I think it goes beyond that. What the phenomenon really says is that our universe is a subset of something else.
Jacques, stay with us. Just wonderful discussion with you, my friend. We'll be back in a moment. Remote viewer Paul Smith joins us as well. There's a connection here. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And remote viewer Paul Smith joins us as well. So we'll be back with Paul Smith, Dr. Jacques Vallée, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Paul Smith. Paul has degrees from BYU and the National Defense Intelligence College. He is a doctoral candidate in philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin. Of his 20 years as an Army intelligence officer, he spent 7 years as a remote viewer for the military Stargate remote viewing program. Paul now teaches remote viewing commercially. Paul's book, Reading the Enemy's Mind, was chosen as a book bonus feature and editor's choice by Reader's Digest. He is president of the not-for-profit International Remote Viewing Association and is completing production on a course introducing military dowsing principles to the public. He joins us tonight on Coast to Coast. Paul, welcome.
Thanks, George. It's always nice to be here.
It's a pleasure. And by the way, I have to congratulate you on bringing Dr. Jacques Vallée back to, I think, the public eye. This is one of the greatest stories I've come across since I've been doing Coast to Coast, Paul, and for the years that I've been wanting to chat with Dr. Vallée, and I'm glad that you were able to get him to come out.
Well, I'm happy that you're pleased, but, you know, I really can't take a lot of credit for it. I did the arrangements, but really Ingo Swann is the one that talked to Jacques about it, and he recommended that I contact him in the first place. And so,
all right, so we'll thank Ingo as well.
Absolutely.
And then we'll bring Jacques Vallée into the conversation. The three of us will just chat about what's been going on. Now, Jacques, you were involved in remote viewing from the get-go, almost. How did that happen for you?
Well, it was a, if you believe in coincidence, it was an interesting coincidence. Before I joined the Stanford Research Institute, you know, when I moved to California, I was working at the campus computer facility at Stanford University, and I was a member of the Palo Alto Research Group, which was a parapsychology, you know, a group of mostly academics and psychologists and doctors and physicists interested in parapsychology generally, and we would get together once or twice a month and listen to lectures and occasionally do some experiments. And there were two physicists who were members of the group, and that was, of course, Dr. Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ. And so I became acquainted with them and with some of the people doing experiments there. And then I went from Stanford University to SRI to join a project in the very early days of computer networking that was called ARPANET. And ARPANET was, at the time, was funded by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. SRI had the second machine on the ARPANET. I don't need to tell you how many millions of computers there are now on the Internet. We had engine number two. And it was fascinating to join that project. So I joined SRI on the Doug Engelbart's augmentation research program, and which was designed to try to augment the capacity of groups of people to handle masses of information through computer networks. And I had the privilege of following that entire piece of scientific history from the early days of the ARPANET to today, of course, the Internet.
And that was a pretty well-kept secret in that, Jacques. Not a lot of people were really aware that you were doing all this.
Well, it was never really a secret. There was what the amazing, you know, the interesting coincidence was that I was at SRI at the same time when Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ joined SRI with some private funding. And in those days, it was funding by, you know, friends and a few wealthy people who were interested in parapsychology. So it was not classified in the early days. It was kept quiet because they did not want to be inundated with publicity in the very early days of a project that was going to be a strict scientific project. Then, so I was privileged to be privy to the project as a friend, and since I was I was a senior engineer at SRI, and they trusted me. There was another aspect to it, which was that several of the early subjects, and they hate the word psychic. You know, psychic really doesn't really mean anything. We don't really know what it means. These people were co-experimenters and subjects. Many of them had experiences that included, you know, what has to be called UFO experiences.
Sure.
I was there as an unpaid consultant and friend and counselor to parts of the project in the early days.
Paul, the fact that someone of Jacques' caliber comes to the table in the field of remote viewing, what has that done, do you think, for what you used to go through?
I'm sorry, I used to what?
With what you used to go through with remote viewing.
Right. Well, I think it's actually very valuable. You've gotten to know him now as you've been on the air with him for a while, and you know how
sure.
credible he comes across.
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
And I think that adds a real quality element to the field. We always welcome that. Of course, there's plenty of those detracting from the quality element as well. So we need as many allies as we can get, and I was very excited to hear about Jacques coming out of the closet, if you will, on the remote viewing stuff. So I think that's wonderful.
Are you a remote viewer, Jacques, or simply someone who is on the outside looking in?
At the beginning, I was on the outside looking in. When Ingo Swann came to SRI, he would come to SRI for a week or two at a time and consult on the program, and we used to have lunch together. Often with the rest of the program, and sometimes just the two of us. And I was, of course, you know, fascinated with his talent and his experiences. And I was asking him, well, what is it exactly that you do, and how does it work? I've been, you know, fascinated and interested in consciousness for a long time. By the way, Dr. Hynek also was very interested in parapsychology, you know, all his life. Ingo would tell me, and I hope that I don't really, betray or change his perception of what he would say. Mm-hmm. I hate to put words in his mouth, but my recollection is that he would say, I can move my consciousness to different places. And he, at the time, he was very, very bored with the experiments we were doing, which was, you know, guessing cards and that type of thing, which was absolutely would be the best way to kill any talent that people would have.
Sure.
in parapsychology. So he was very bored with that, and he wanted to do other things. And one time we were having lunch, and I told him, look, if that's what you do, then there are some analogies, of course, crude analogies with computer science. In information science, of course, a computer has to be able to find data, and it can find data in a number of ways. There is something that we call direct addressing, where you tell the computer, go get whatever is in cell number 25. Or you have indirect addressing, where the program will tell the computer, go look at cell number 25, you know, memory location 25, and you would find the address of the data I want you to look at. And the data may be, you know, address 3721, and then the computer will go to 3721, but next time it may be something different, because the program is going to change what's in that location, but it's always at the same location. It's like, you know, my sending you a letter. It may be a different letter every day, but it always goes to your mailbox. And then as computers have become more and more sophisticated, of course, the memory is too small for the databases we handle. And you go to virtual memory where you don't really have an address. You know that the memory location you're going to look at is out there on mass storage somewhere. It may not even be at the same location. It may be on the network, you know, far away. And you have a statistical way of getting to it. So what I was telling Ingo, and Ingo was very interested in that whole concept, what I was telling him is we need to find out what the scheme is. If it's when you think of a location or somebody gives you a location, do you go directly there or do you go indirectly or is it a virtual world? And we need to do experiments to do that. And then Ingo thought about this and came up with coordinate remote viewing where if I tell you go see the Eiffel Tower, you don't have to be much of a psychic to draw the Eiffel Tower because right. Everybody knows where it is and what it is. If I tell you go to coordinate such and such, you know, longitude and such latitude, it may be the coordinate of the Eiffel Tower, but you don't know that. And that is a key, and of course it's a completely arbitrary key, to a particular location on Earth. So it's a crude way of defining where you want to go. Later on, they moved away from coordinate remote viewing, and by then I was no longer privy to the project. I had moved on, and I was doing other things. I had started my own company, and I was no longer at SRI, so I was still friends with the people. I heard about what they were doing, but by then the project had become classified, and I really wasn't privy to the operational side of it. But they went to, we now know that they went to something just calling it target, which is a very military term to designate something, and there may be other ways of doing it. My regret is that we never did the experiments that we had wanted to do. I mean, we never got back, because the project was very successful at the beginning. It was taken over by, and rightly so, by people who wanted to apply it to specific missions. It became very mission-oriented before the science was fully done. And I think that's part of the problem of the field now.
What was it about remote viewing, Jacques, that was there that allowed you to augment your theories on ufology and that entire field of consciousness? What was it?
Well, I should say in the 80s, the project had developed considerably, had been funded at a much higher level, and the SRI team asked me to come back as a cleared consultant to the project. And at the time, the project was Grill Flame. And then I went back into the project, you know, a few hours a week, because I was working somewhere else. And I was trained by Ingo in the formal training of remote viewing. We were part of the methodology team. I was never part of the operational team that Paul is part of. What fascinated me was, and I'm not a very good remote viewer, but I understand the process.
Right.
It's as if you were teaching me to play the violin. You know, I'm never going to be Igor Oistrakh, but I can understand how it works. Once you do it, you're surprised by what you can actually do and where it takes you. You get it. Even if you're not going to be, you know, professional in that field. And it taught me, again, that we certainly don't understand how consciousness relates to space, and especially how consciousness relates to time. One of the things that the SRI experiments clearly established, and that we found out later that the Russians had done the same experiments and came to the same conclusion, is that, yes, you can go to a particular place in space, but you can go to the place in space where you're going to be tomorrow. Without, in other words, precognition is part of the process. And that means that we really have a problem with causality. We really have a problem with the sense of time as a dimension in physics. And that relates to UFOs directly.
Paul, I want to get your take and also yours, Jacques, on Ingo's book, Penetration, which he claims that he remote viewed the moon and saw artificial structures. Paul, you want to tell us that story a little bit, and then we'll get both your reaction to that?
Well, there's two parts of the story, actually. There's the part that Ingo relates in Penetration. And he the first half of the book is very interesting. The last half is more of an analysis research material that he delved into. But the first half of the book is his own experiences as he relates them. And it involves a number of things, including a visit somewhere to the North Woods where he observes some kind of odd object that could be described perhaps as a UFO that was going around zapping the landscape. That was quite a provocative story there. And then he tells a number of other stories where he encounters what he believes firmly were aliens of some sort masquerading as humans. Although, of course, that begs the question, are aliens also human? It's hard to say. But at any rate, he describes that. And then he talks about the moon and all those features that he determined to be there. I'm a little vague right now on whether he talked about his actual remote viewing experiences, remote viewing the moon. My main experience with it was later on when he asked me to do some remote viewing sessions, and he gave me a coordinate, and he didn't tell me where it involved the moon. And so I'm getting these very interesting pieces of information through the remote viewing process, and a little bit later on, when I saw the he passed to me the results that he and another gentleman had done, and turned out it was lunar the results we got, and not just that our data tended to be quite similar. There was a definite correlation between the things that I described and sketched, and things that Ingo and this other guy had, and I had. You know, I was not Ingo. I think must have been working front loaded, which I'm always worried about. But it was quite interesting to see that I whatever the grammar there is was not working front loaded. Did not know what the coordinates where they pointed. Ended up with similar data. I thought that was quite interesting, and it did involve structures and entities of some sort. Very odd descriptive kinds of things. I was unclear exactly what they were, but some of my descriptions were clearly not something I would expect to encounter in an earthly setting. So,
could you conclude, though, Paul, that perhaps whatever Ingo saw was truly artificial?
Well, if the viewing was accurate, if it was veridical, then the only way to describe it would be as artificial. Artificial, of course, what does that mean? Constructed by some intelligent entity or agency.
Why? Okay, but why would it not be accurate? I mean, here we're using his work, and you picked up some things.
Well, first off, I have to say I'm always very cautious in these kinds of claims. You always have to be careful because there are some interesting things that happen in remote viewing. My worry has been all along that maybe I picked up telepathically on what Ingo himself was seeing, or at least thought he was seeing, and there's no way to rule that out. The only way to find out if we were right is to actually go there. The fact that we did correlate and I was blind to the target, that's at least one stage towards being convincing, right? There is always a possibility there's some telepathic overlay. Not, it's hard to tell if there was, but At least there was some corroboration there between the two, and that keeps me from saying, oh, it was a bunch of baloney, and leads me to think that there may well have been something to what we were actually perceiving.
What was it, Paul, we're at the break. We'll come right back with Paul Smith and Jacques Vallée on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest tonight, of course, Dr. Jacques Vallée, Paul Smith, next hour. We'll open up the phone lines for you on Coast to Coast AM. Jacques, tell us why you finally decided to speak publicly at the RV experiences and at this conference that Paul's going to tell us about in a moment.
As Paul mentioned, Ingo, and I've stayed in touch with him. I've had many discussions with him. I visit with him whenever I'm in New York City. And He told me about this conference and suggested we were reminiscing about the early days of the program. There have been, as you know, many fine books that have been written about remote viewing, including Paul's own book. But the very early days have not been, the story really hasn't been told. And Ingo thought it could be a contribution that, you know, people should know about how it started. And that's why I agreed to do it.
How'd you get interested, Jacques, in parapsychology?
I was, it's hard not to be interested in parapsychology when you're a scientist. We don't know much about human consciousness. A lot of things challenge you in science about how do we grasp facts about the universe? How much of it is our imagination, or how do we build a consensus reality versus what's really there? How do we know it's really there? Even in physics, of course, in quantum mechanics, you learn that a lot of reality is built out of a statistical process. And that consciousness has a role in shaping that process. So I became interested because of that, and also because of being aware of the early research that had been done in Europe.
Were you always happy with the work, Jacques? Any disappointments there?
Yes. Sure. I think the involvement of the three-letter agencies, you know, the intelligence agencies, mm-hmm. the miniature agencies in the work was in part a blessing and in part a curse, because the without that support, the work could never have been done. If Dr. Putoff and Dr. Tark had gone to, you know, the National Science Foundation or some of the open science agencies, they would have been turned down simply on the basis that, you know, there is no such thing as psychic functioning, and we don't need to fund this. Of course, the three-letter agencies were interested for other reasons, which is that they thought this might be applied to mission-oriented work. And of course, as you remember, the early 70s were a time of intense involvement, especially in the Middle East. There were the hostages in Iran. There was real desperation at trying to find out what was happening to those people. There were a number of those things that really demanded new ways of trying to access information. And that was the good part of the program. That's what made it possible. But then, perhaps because of the initial success of the program, it became, and I think this is shown very, very well in Paul's book, Reading the Mind of the Enemy, a lot of people started to think that this worked every time. This was like, you know, a slide rule on a computer, that if you put two and two into it, you know, four would come out. And that's not the case. The research had not been done to the point where we could trust the results every time. And I was, you know, certainly very aware of that, because on the methodology side, we had done a number of experiments. I had done my own experiments over the years, and I knew that this is not a computer. It's not even a microscope or a telescope, where you get data, you can interpret, and you may disagree about the interpretation, but at least the data is there. In remote viewing, you have to be extremely careful. And Ingo, of course, was the first to point that out with what he called overlays. Your imagination cannot be turned off completely, and it will play a role in building the reality of what you're reporting. And that research was never completed, and it was never completed because everything became mission-oriented after that.
Are you happy with the pace of remote viewing, Paul, or do you think it slowed down considerably?
Well, obviously it slowed down since the government involvement ended. It slowed down in one way in the hard science research. As far as, obviously, public interest, that's mushroomed and ballooned, which is also a mixed blessing. In one respect, we have a lot of people interested in it. In another respect, of course, we get all kinds of claims and essentially wild stories being told about it. So you end up with a lot more wheat, but you also end up with a lot more chaff in the process. So I would love to see some really serious research undertaken. In fact, ironically, in the United States especially, support for parapsychology research, even the very rigorous scientific sort, has declined dramatically in the last 10-15 years, perhaps even a bit longer than that. And the irony is, then, here is a huge interest in public interest in remote viewing, and yet there is really not much in the way of fundamental research being done, and there is so much we could find out about it. There's so much. One of my goals as president of IRVA is to try and find a way where we can get some resources committed to some worthwhile research projects and at least get going with some basic research again to help us broaden what we understand, help us improve the process of remote viewing, help us maybe make new discoveries about how it interrelates with other aspects of human nature, particularly consciousness, as Jacques often mentions here.
Paul, before I get back into talking about some other UFO questions with Jacques, tell us about the conference.
Well, it's going to be great, and of course, it's a big part of that being great is Jacques coming to speak as our keynote speaker.
Oh, I think this is wonderful. I really do.
You know, I'm just sorry that you have something else scheduled, because I bet we could talk you into coming if you didn't have a conflict.
You are right about that, my friend.
We've got Jacques speaking, and of course a number of other folks. Stephen Schwartz again is going to address us, and he's going to talk about his new book that's out. Lynn Buchanan, myself, I'm going to talk a bit more about dowsing and how it crosswalks with remote viewing, how the two together can actually do things that either one separately may not be able to. We've got Jessica Utz, which I'm looking forward to hearing from her again. She's our scientific presence on the board, of course not accepting Jacques here, but Jessica is going to talk about, give us some real interesting insights into research and how conflicts between two research projects actually led to more understanding of remote viewing and how it interacts with consciousness. So we're also going to have a panel, by the way, on ethics, remote viewing ethics. That's a hot topic among some folks.
Now, what do you mean by that, remote viewing ethics? Give
well,
me an example.
You know, we've had a lot of public debate recently about the administration's attempts to loosen up surveillance and eavesdropping on people with foreign contacts in the United States, things such as that. And if that's a problem, can you imagine where someone might conceivably be able to, so shall we say, spy on someone else without there being any way of detecting that that spying is going on or any way of stopping it, even if there was? Electronically, of course, there's a that can be a threat to personal liberty and privacy. If you imagine using the power of your mind to spy on someone, the question is, to what extent do we have to be, or to what extent does ethics get involved in remote viewing? Some folks have this favorite saying, what it would be like if there were no more secrets. You know, remote viewing, of course, taken to its logical extreme, if we ever arrive at that, could very well mean that there are no secrets. But, you know, there are some things that really ought to be. People's private lives, you know, people's personal affairs and things like that. To what extent should a remote viewer allow him or herself to be involved in things that might have ethical questions about them?
Did you ever remote view into someone's brain?
Well, of course, to be a little facetious, if you mean down to the synapses and the neurons, no. But
you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. Yeah, actually, or at least that seemed to be what we were doing. We often used as a sort of heuristic or an interpretive device or means of understanding a sort of tasking process. We'd be deep in a remote viewing session. We might identify some people at a certain target in order to find out a bit more about the nature of the target, the purposes. And these are, of course, abstract things. You can go into a room and find a bunch of books and a table and a desk and things of that nature, and you still wouldn't know whether you're in a library, a law office, or a schoolroom. What's different about those things is really the abstract notions, the abstract concepts, and you can't get those just by looking at the things. So oftentimes we would find people at a target, and the monitor, the interviewer might say, okay, you found a person, describe this person, and we'd give a description, a physical description, and then say, okay, ask this person what they're doing here, why they're here, or what the purpose is, some question like that. And so we'd pose this question, and we would get answers, and quite frequently the answers turn out to be right. So here's the question. We're posing these things nonverbally to an individual who doesn't know we're there or even addressing him or her, and yet we're getting veridical information in the process. So are we essentially downloading the mental contents of that person? It would suggest we were. Now, of course, there's a couple of alternative explanations. But nonetheless, oftentimes it seemed that we were in some way accessing people's thoughts in an interesting way.
Okay, let's move on to you, Jacques, for just a second here. Do you believe that the things we've been talking about all night, including some of the remote viewing and also the talk of UFOs, is there a cover-up? Has it been ongoing?
In, well, Of course, that's the $64 million question. I believe that the government, not just the U.S. government, but many governments, have data that about UFOs, about specific cases, that should be turned over to the scientific community and to the public at large. There is no reason why it should be kept classified. We know that all of us who've done work in the field, talking to people and talking to witnesses, have heard stories about, when I was in the Air Force, I saw this and that, and when I landed, there were two guys waiting for me, and they debriefed me for 3 hours, and they told me not to talk about it. And those cases don't show up in the files of Project Blue Book, or that's only something that we were aware of when I was working with Dr. Hynek. It was very frustrating. We knew that there were cases that were not in the files. And so where are they? There are, I believe, hundreds of those cases, and those are the ones that have the most data, perhaps the most physical data from radar and from photographs and other things. I found the same situation in Brazil. I was privileged to be able to talk to the military task force that surveyed and actually observed a number of objects over the mouth of the Amazon in 1977. I reviewed those cases with them. I saw one of their reports. There are two other reports that are classified that I've never been able to see, and in fact that they don't have access to anymore. The same thing happens in France. There was a big announcement that France had released their secret UFO files. Well, I know that project. I've been certainly a friend of the project, a friend of the people who are running it. I've seen those files before, and they were not secret. They were like Blue Book. They were private for reasons of privacy of the witnesses. But those files had nothing especially classified about them. France was not the first country to release its files. As you know, the Project Blue Book files have been available on the internet and in microfilm for many, many years. Great Britain has done the same thing. Spain has done the same thing. But the question is there other data somewhere? I believe there is. And in fact, I know there is. I have not had access to that. Maybe we should remote view that sometime, Paul.
That has been proposed. I want to kind of step out of normal format here and ask a question, if I may. George, is that okay?
Sure. This is a roundtable. The three of us. Go ahead.
I'm curious, and I don't have any special knowledge about any of this, but let's say there was some evidence from UFOs, unexplained aerial phenomena, and it was classified. What kinds of evidence, Jacques, do you think would merit being classified?
I asked that question of Dr. Hynek. I asked it of the officers at Project Blue Book. And Project Blue Book was housed at the Foreign Technology Division of the Air Force, which is an intelligence organization. And they told me, yes, some of the cases we won't show you because they are classified and you're not cleared for that, but they are not very important. They are just classified because of where the observers were, or who they were, or the fact that the object was tracked by a radar that was a classified piece of equipment at the time. And it doesn't mean that there is evidence for UFO reality there. Somebody saw a light, but that somebody was, in a sensitive situation or on board a ship that was at a classified location, that case is going to be classified, even though the UFO is not very interesting. Well, that's one type of thing that would be legitimate classification. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is cases, for example, in France, where somebody saw something and reported it, and the next day the military was there, and the military was there with recording equipment, with Geiger counters, with photographs, with measuring equipment. And that case is, you can never find it anywhere after that. Same thing in the U.S., same thing in certainly in Brazil. Those cases, somebody went to a lot of trouble documenting these cases, and these are usually close encounter cases with trace evidence, maybe with material being recovered, and you never see where they go. Now, those are the cases that the scientific community should see. I mean, that's what would change the opinion of the scientific community.
Yeah, I understand. Could there be any evidence that by its very nature would deserve being classified? I'm trying to think of something like that.
I think it's much more that it goes from the military to the political level. And I think for a politician, there's nothing to be gained by having one more thing that the public is worried about. There have been all these reports about the stability of society and people would freak out if they knew and so on, which is obviously stupid. I mean, people are much more mature than people suppose. Certainly now, enough time has passed that the passion would be taken out of much of this, and it could be looked at in the light of science.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very good. For both of you, we're going to take this quick break. We'll come right back. This is what we shall do. We'll open up the phone lines. If you have a remote viewing specific question, that'll go to Paul Smith. If you've got anything else that we've been talking about with Dr. Jacques Vallée, it's all his. So a twofold question and answer session coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. Paul, where is the conference?
Conference is in Las Vegas, Nevada at the Alexis Park Resort and Hotel. It's going to be the 19th to the 21st of October. We thought we'd pick a relatively cool time in Las Vegas instead of in the middle of summer when we've had it before.
All right. And the website, of course, for people who want more information?
Is irvaconference.org, I-R-V-A, the word conference.org.
Excellent. We're going to take some calls. And Dr. Vallée, I want you to know you are invited on this program anytime you want.
Thank you very much. I'm really enjoying this.
Let's go to the phones. This hour is going to fly by. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, please.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
We are fine. Thanks. Go ahead.
I've got a question. This may sound unusual, but I wondered if remote viewing can be done by a visually impaired person, which I am.
Paul, I'll let you handle that one.
As a matter of fact, there's some evidence that it can be. Of course, this is one of those areas where I'd love to see a lot more research done. I think it was the 2004 conference, we had a presenter come who had done, it was more of clairvoyance, not exactly remote viewing, but they're so closely related it almost doesn't matter. She had done some clairvoyance work with a number of visually impaired folks and had some success with it. I think what would be interesting to see, of course, there's different ways people are visually impaired. It can be an optical nerve problem, it can be a retinal problem, or it can be damage to the visual cortex.
Right.
And if it's damage to the visual cortex, and this would be the extreme case, which would be the most interesting, I think, is...
That's what I am.
A visual cortex issue?
No, I have two plastic eyes due to glaucoma.
I understand. In principle, there's no reason why it couldn't work for you, because the rest of your visual apparatus presumably is intact.
No, the optic nerve is gone.
Is it too? Okay, well, that's not essential either. At least according to the way I think this all works, I think what happens when you remote view, obviously the optical nerve and the retinas are not probably involved, but there is some suggesting that somewhere further downstream in the visual process that some of those brain structures may get stimulated. And if that's the case, you know, then if everything's working other than optical nerve and retinas, you should, in theory, be able to at least get some visual input from a remote viewing process. Now, that's not guaranteed. That's where some research would be very valuable. But some standard perceptual research fairly recently indicates that when we think of a visual memory, then the visual centers in the brain actually get activated. So there's no reason why it couldn't be the case that in a remote viewing experience that those same centers might be activated as well, which, of course, if we could research that with the right equipment, would be evidence for remote viewing.
Okay, there you go. Thanks, Paul. Dr. Vallee, your thoughts on, did you ever know John Mack, the late John Mack?
Yes, I did.
Okay, he, you know, of course, devoted his life to the phenomenon of alien abductions. Your take on that, what do you think is happening to people?
I met John Mack first at the home of Lawrence Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
At the Rockefeller Complex in Tarrytown.
He was financing some of the research, right?
Yes, he did. Dr. Mack was someone of towering intelligence, not afraid of controversy, as he had shown in his career. And he became, so at the time, we sort of became friends, and I saw him several times after that. We compared notes on a number of cases. I asked him, of course, you know, how do you use hypnosis in your practice? And he said, I've never used hypnosis in my practice. I relearned it when I became involved with UFOs. His practice in psychiatry was addressing completely different issues. And I was frankly disappointed in that, because to me, hypnosis, and again, I don't speak as an expert, certainly in psychology.
Sure.
I don't think, from what I've read, that hypnosis is the right way to study abductions. And that's why I stayed away from that whole discussion. I think it's the use of hypnosis, the way it is practiced, is unscientific and unethical. We're using, as you may know, hypnosis is not admitted certainly not in California courts, certainly not the way it's practiced currently in the UFO field. It could be admitted, it's admitted in court in very specific cases with very specific guidelines that are not followed by ufologists. The ufologists are untrained in the practice, are not trained professionally, and I think the results are not reliable. I believe that there is a phenomenon there, that these people have experienced something. I've studied about 70 cases of hypnosis. In some cases, the witnesses wanted to be hypnotized. We did not do that. We instituted a procedure, always with professionals involved. I've never done the hypnosis myself, always, and I would not. But I've brought in professionals who induced a state of reverie that would be conducive to people remembering more. But all the studies I've seen about hypnosis show that you get more data by hypnosis, and you get a lot more unreliable data. So you're not improving the signal-to-noise ratio, if you will.
Back to the phone.
That was my point of disagreement with Dr. Mack.
Okay. Wildcard line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Please go
Hi,
ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I have a, wanted to talk to your guest. I believe his name is Paul. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Paul Smith, yes.
Paul, okay. I only got to listen to a portion of your show this evening, but you were speaking about remote viewing, and just share briefly with you an experience that I have that recurs for me. I do a lot of research, often late in the evenings, mostly to do with electronics and software development, mm-hmm. and I spend quite a bit of time on it. And there are certain subjects when I'm working on them, I suddenly feel like there's sort of a block, sort of, you know, like an energy drain, like, you know, it's just time to stop. And I've done research and had interest in these things most of my life. And I don't know very much at all about remote viewing, but I do know that a lot of times I'm really spending a lot of mental energy thinking about a subject and things that perhaps other people are working on. And the question for you was, Have you ever had an experience or anything that would lead you to believe one way or another as to whether remote viewing is active or passive? In other words, could it be detected? Could someone know that you're doing a remote viewing, and could they perhaps alter what you see?
Well, any concrete evidence is that it's passive, that it is not detectable. There are stories that some of the remote viewers tell where they feel as if they're out remote viewing, they're in a certain environment, they're a certain, in the area of a certain target, and there are different versions of the story. One is where they encounter someone else who is also out there remote viewing, and that person is aware of them working the target, so to speak. There are occasional stories of viewers who say that they've gone to a target and they were absolutely convinced that someone or something at the target perceived them there as well. Now, I don't know what to make of these. There is no external evidence that any such thing like that happened. And, of course, remote viewing is somewhat notorious for having this overlay, as Jacques mentioned earlier, where your left brain is working while your right brain is working, and the left brain's job is to interpret data, interpret impressions, and it normally does that very well in regular waking life. But when you get into remote viewing, which is a low-bandwidth situation, you're not getting a lot of data throughput, and the left brain has much less to work with, it jumps to conclusions about things and is quite frequently wrong about them. It's quite possible that some sort of imaginative or analytical overlay plays a role in those with those viewers who think that someone or something at the target has perceived them. Of course, on the other hand, without any conclusive evidence one way or another, it is also possible that maybe they were perceived. But even in that case, it's really very much a passive sort of activity. The corollary to the other side of it is called remote influencing, which I think is much more problematic. So, I don't know. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, back to the next wildcard line. Hi there. You're on the air with us.
I'm sorry. Is this wildcard?
It is the wildcard, and I believe
okay.
It's you.
Mm-hmm. And my name is Caroline, and I live up in Ontario, Canada. I have a question about satellites. So I wanted to speak with...
Dr. Vallée?
Dr. Vallée, yeah.
Okay.
Yes?
I want to know, a friend of mine, here's the story. She is absolutely, insistent that there's a UFO just hanging out here over Toronto. And I must admit, I haven't seen it before, and it's quite bright. And I said to her, look, that's a satellite. And she said, no, satellites move. She said, like the moon does. She said, so when the planet rotates, the moon is gone. So I said, well, I don't know very much about it. I had to really think. So can you shed some light on that? This is very elementary, I realize that. But would it stay there or would it not move?
No, an artificial satellite would move quite quickly. In a few minutes, it would cross the sky above your location.
Well, this isn't moving. It's there and it's very bright. Yeah, it's been there. And she says it comes, and then sometimes for a week or so it won't be there, and then it comes back.
Sounds like a planet, doesn't it, Jacques?
My guess would be that that you're looking at a star.
Well, that's what I thought. But,
or a planet, but more likely a star that may be seen through clouds or through layers of fog or some atmospheric condition that makes it seem that it's unusual. And that's a very common, believe me, even astronomers have been fooled by that occasionally. So it's not something to be ashamed of. It's just, learning about what's in the sky.
No, that's fine.
But it's not a satellite.
Well, so it's not a satellite, no. Well, thank you very much for your time. Bye-bye.
You're quite welcome.
Okay. What do you think the odds are of us getting hit by an asteroid, Jacques?
Well, fortunately, they are very, 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 very slim, which doesn't mean it couldn't happen. We are very fortunate to be in a solar system where there are some heavy planets that tend to attract the asteroids, like Jupiter. You remember a few years ago when a train of asteroids slammed into Jupiter. It was a really spectacular occasion. Fortunately, you know, the Earth is lighter and doesn't attract as much of the heavy asteroids. We are getting to the point where we can not only detect them, but have a good chance of predicting their trajectory and maybe trying to influence it, for example, by deflecting those things when they are still far away.
All right, next up, east of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Tim from Tampa Bay.
Hey, Tim.
And I know you love the concept of coincidence, but I think I have a theory on why so many heads of state are keeping quiet about UFO data. I'm sure you'll all find it curious that there is no topic under the sun that we can find as common ground for so many heads of state to agree on anything except UFOs and extraterrestrials. But let's say, for example, that the extraterrestrials are, in fact, from another solar system. Well, considering the distance that they would have to travel, they would have to have, among their technology, time travel. Can we agree on that?
It's a possibility. Yes.
Well,
when you're traveling in space, you're traveling in time at, you know, at the same time. Relativity tells us that the faster you go, the more some distortion would happen, and we don't know enough about time to know whether people could, there might be ways of actually folding space-time to move very, very fast from one point in the universe to another.
Okay, thank you. I was hoping you'd be with me on that, because if they do have a means of using time travel to bend time to their convenience to get from another solar system to ours, once they get here, they may not wish for the governments to announce or confirm their presence here until they say so. In other words, it could be their agenda. And the way to keep the heads of state quiet would be, I don't know if you recall the movie It's a Wonderful Life with Jim Stewart.
It's a classic.
Isn't it? I make my kids watch it every year. But anyway, again, by coincidence, Clarence, the angel, was an extraterrestrial who showed Jimmy Stewart what it would be like had he never been born. Now, if the extraterrestrials that visit us want to exert influence over the heads of state to keep quiet about the UFO presence, they can say, look, if you remember that movie, we have time travel at our disposal. We can take you back into your childhood and alter your destiny so that you'll never become who you are today. Now, what better leverage to put over a head of state than to say you will never become who you are? You'll, in fact, wind up making fries at a McDonald's someplace. Does that sound like a viable theory?
Well, it's a good science fiction idea. I think it certainly could be a book or a movie. I think there are more simple explanations. First, one of them is, you know, we've talked earlier about the fact that governments must have a lot of data that has never been shared with the scientific community or with the public. That doesn't mean they have the answers. And that's a mistake that we always make in this field. We assume that because somebody has data, that they have the answers. Well, in science, gee, we have tons of data about the sun. There are still things about the sun that we absolutely don't understand. I mean, there are phenomena in the solar corona. There are phenomena about the interior of the sun that we don't understand, even though we can watch the sun every day. We have tons of data about it. Same thing about, say, cancer. I mean, there are hundreds of people who die of cancer every day. You can do autopsies. You can do experiments. You can do analyses.
that's still, you know, the real solution to the problem of cancer still eludes medicine. And it may be the same thing. It may be that governments have tons of data about UFOs, but they can't make any sense out of it. Suppose you were, you know, the best physicist in the 16th century, and somebody gave you, you know, a card from a board from a computer. Somebody gave you a Pentium 3. What are you going to do with it?
Stay with us, Jacques and Paul. We'll be back. We'll take final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Jacques, we haven't had a chance really to talk about your other life, your venture capital life. We'll do that one day when you come back again. I guess, you know, venture capitalists, I think, are one of the main reasons so many great things have happened, not only in this country, but in industry around this planet.
Much of the new technology has been funded and managed by venture capital, and it's a fascinating profession. It's also a lesson in humility, because you have people in your office every day who show you that you know how much has happened since you went to school and how much you don't know, and it keeps you on your toes.
Frustrating sometimes to turn down a project because you can't fund everything, right?
Well, and you know, every venture capital firm has a list of the ones that got away, the ones that you should have funded and turned into great companies that you didn't do because you just didn't see the potential. And
back to the phones. You ready?
Yes.
I cut you off, though. Go ahead. Finish your story about the venture capitalists.
No, it's just a lesson in humility, and it's fascinating to be in touch with people who are so creative all the time and bring you new ideas.
All right. Thank you. First-time caller line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Chris from upstate New York.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Sure. First off, I just wanted to tell you that I really enjoy your show, and I listen to it every night.
Well, thank you for being such a devoted listener. Go ahead.
And I just have two quick questions, if I can ask them.
Sure.
Okay. My first question is for you, George. I know someone that does interviews, and one of the people that he interviewed claims to have alien encounters regularly, if not on a daily basis, and she seems to have a lot of UFO knowledge. And she talks about Roswell and different alien races and things like that. And I just thought it'd be really interesting to have her talk on your show. And I have her contact info if you would like me to pass that on to you.
Yeah, just email it and just reference the fact that you were on the show tonight so I know it was you, okay?
Okay, great. And then my second question is for Dr. Vallée.
Yes?
And Dr. Vallée, do you feel that aliens can be a deception of the media, or what are your thoughts on it? Can aliens have a good demeanor, and that the media may be misleading us to fear these aliens?
Well, the media does what the media always does. It's projecting its own interests, or the interests of the public at any given time. So perception of what would be an alien has changed over the years. You know, if you go back to the early movies, you know, the day the Earth stood still, and those movies, people perceived aliens as one way. I think the main contribution, the great contribution that Mr. Spielberg made was to show aliens as not necessarily terrifying creatures, but intelligent and curious and rather friendly creatures. We don't know what an alien would, how they would perceive us, or how they would interact with us. Or we just don't know that.
Do you believe that fallen angels might have been perceived, Jacques, as extraterrestrials?
I think that as we discussed before, as you go back in history, the same phenomenon that we tend to interpret today in terms of space aliens would have been interpreted in terms of demons or angels or ghosts or
certainly fairies and leprechauns and so on. When I did the research for Pastor Tumagonia, I found that essentially when you strip out the cultural parameters, you find the phenomenon is the same, that people were describing walking around in the countryside and suddenly being confronted with smaller creatures and objects that did strange things, lights that flew very rapidly and could land and take off and leave traces, and again, throughout history.
Okay, next up, let's go to our wild card line. Your turn. Hi there.
Evening, gentlemen. This is Stan from Louisville.
Hey, Stan.
My question is for Dr. Jarre.
Okay.
I was listening to Stanton Friedman several years ago on this program, and he was saying that Sweden had an aggressive program where they were sending fighter jets up to chase these things, and they were putting out public knowledge as to basically everything they knew about aliens. Did we find out anything from Sweden? And what's your opinion on Stanton Friedman, sir? And I'll hang up and listen.
I have a lot of admiration for Stanton Friedman. We agree on many, many things. We disagree on a few of them, but that's always an honest disagreement and a fun discussion. I have a lot of respect for the people who spend a lot of time in the field, because it takes a lot of dedication, hard work, hard research, and Stanton is one of the people who have been there and done that and spent the time. I don't know much about Sweden. There are a number of reports that have come from Scandinavian countries that have been very open, where there was the testimony, the records were published. There are reports in Norway. There is a series of experiments going on where they are tracking lights that seem to happen repeatedly over the same areas of the country. Those have been very well run research projects. Now, there were a number of reports in right after World War II of what they called strange rockets, ghost rockets over Sweden and all of Scandinavia. There was a lot of research that was done at the time by the Allied Services and by the U.S. Air Force. I don't think all of that has been published. It's still somewhat of a mystery to me.
Jacques, I'm curious if you looked into it all, because you weren't very public then. But in 1997, the Phoenix Lights, where even now their former governor claims that he believes it might have been an extraterrestrial craft of some type. You heard about that?
I don't know much about it. I've read the same information you have. I'm aware of those reports. I don't know what to think, frankly.
Okay. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
George, I'd like to ask Dr. Vallee if there is such a thing as a spontaneous remote viewing experience. I awakened one morning and knew I had to be somewhere and didn't know how to get there. When I was considering calling my friend, it was like a little TV camera went on in the center of my forehead, and it zoomed in on this gravelly area where there was a red tent, a blue tent, and a white tent, and it was very vivid. And then it clicked off, and I thought, why did I see that? How strange. I didn't connect it with where I was going. Later that afternoon, when I found directions to the Long Beach area, I found myself driving on a gravelly road, and there was the red tent, the green tent, and the white tent.
Hmm.
Now, what happened?
We'll let you both touch on that if you want. You first, Paul.
Well, yes, actually. Spontaneous RV, if we want to call it that, certainly happens. There's a long history of spontaneous psi or spontaneous psychic events. People report in all kinds of circumstances, situations. And the fact is that everybody has the underlying faculty that allows us to have these kind of experiences. And there's two ways of experiencing them. Either you can be taught how to do it, or somehow you just happen to be in the right mental framework and the right circumstances at the right time when it just happens to you. A lot of psi events, spontaneous psi events, occur when there's some kind of trauma that happens to someone distant from you that you're attached to, but not all of them. They can sometimes be just interesting little vignettes like you described here.
Okay, and Jacques, do you want to touch on that?
Spontaneous remote viewing absolutely happens. It can happen in dreams, and it can happen in waking reality.
Very good. Let's go next to our next wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Chris Fletcher?
Yeah, Chris, go ahead.
Yes, actually, my question is for both of you. I'm a big science guy. I like to go to the NASA websites and look at the pictures that the Hubble telescope takes and whatnot, but I'm just trying to figure out. They just recently put Pluto as a planet, no longer a planet. All right, they can see billions and trillions of miles away with this telescope. And this planet, I think they found one bigger than Pluto out in the Kuiper Belt.
Yes.
I'm trying to figure out, how do they call this they can call that another dwarf planet, but they're not calling Pluto a planet still.
Well, it's kind of a it's a problem of nomenclature. What do you want to call a planet anyway? And it gets to almost like theological arguments, you know, about nomenclature. I still think of Plato as a planet, frankly. I think those are very, very fine distinctions. Of course, as the technology improves, we discover more and more and more objects in the solar system, and it becomes very confusing. So there is a need for keeping it clear. I think we'll continue to discover members of the solar system that we didn't know were there as we go further and further away.
Next up, Wildcard Line, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hello there.
Yes, hi, you there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, yeah, I disagree with Jacques Vallée. He has this notion that extraterrestrial, that these aliens are not extraterrestrial.
Well, no, he didn't roll that out totally.
I know, I agree. He didn't rule it out completely. But I just like to remind him that the physics, that Earth is only a fraction of the physics, chemistry, matter, and element that's out there, and energy. So if aliens are coming here, they're going to most likely have physics and chemistry and elements and matter that we don't have. So, and there's so much I can say, but we've got so short a time. But the thing is that he mentioned something about that they merge and they separate. Well, an ET civilization can do that with no problem. You know, I liken it to like a toolbox that goes in and out, if you will, but the aliens do it much smoother. So this idea, and also the idea that these aliens are too human-like, that's also, I would say, okay, also nonsense. Why can't God, which I believe in, create beings to resemble us? I think this whole idea that these are aliens are not ET, I think that's disinformation. The right information is what he had in the beginning, that they are extraterrestrial. And also we're being visited by a lot of civilizations, well, several dozen. What, all of them are from other dimensions or something? You know, I feel that they're all from, and people have been abducted. Today. I'm a member of MUFON. MUFON had an extensive research into extraterrestrial civilizations. People have been abducted, have stated that they are from other star systems, and that they just display the different technology than what we have. If you took the X-ray machine and put it in the 1600s, that would be considered not anything human-like. But, of course, that was invented, like, in 1895, I believe. So just because we don't understand something, that doesn't give us the right to say that it's not ET. I can go on, but I'll let you go on.
All right, let's get your reaction, John.
Yeah, we don't – I don't think we disagree. What I'm objecting to is the first level – extraterrestrial theory, which is stated to be that we're being visited by beings that have evolved on another planet and have come here after World War II to study us because of the age of the atom bomb and so on, and that they are doing a study and abducting people to understand the human race. That is contradicted by a number of things that the witnesses are telling us. including the physical phenomena that you've described, the merging, the changing shape, and so on. And that's why, that's precisely why the phenomenon is so interesting, that it goes beyond that first-level hypothesis, that we need to advance the hypothesis, we need to challenge what we know today about physics. I agree completely with you that an X-ray machine in the 16th century would be regarded as something of the devil. It would be regarded as something that was a magical piece of sorcery. That's why we need to put all that in perspective. And again, let me give you an example about a particular case, if we have a few more minutes.
Yes.
There was a case in Northern California I became very interested in, and I described it in a book of mine called Confrontations. These people were miners. They had a claim in Northern California. They had been working the claim. They were seeing a UFO repeatedly. They saw it three times. It was sort of egg-shaped, about 15 to 20 feet in diameter, and it always landed at the same place. Ufologists went there and did a good bit of research, and they published the case, and the UFO had taken off, and they said it took off vertically in a wooded area. Well, I went there, and I sort of became friends with these people, with the witnesses. I went there repeatedly. I believe in long-term study of these cases, not just the one-time interview. And I was puzzled by one thing when I looked at the place, that, and I asked them, well, exactly, tell me again, how did it take off? And they said, well, it took off at an angle. And I said, well, if it took off at an angle over here, it would have to go through the trees. And they said, well, it kind of went through the trees. Well, now, that's not quite the same thing, is it? So I said, well, that's not what the report in this journal, in this UFO journal, and I won't tell you which group, but you can guess, that's not what the report says. And they said, well, you know, the man who came here was so nice, and he really believed in this extraterrestrial physical thing. We didn't have a heart to tell him that the thing went through trees. Well, all of a sudden, it's not quite the same. It could still be extraterrestrial, of course, but it's not the same kind of extraterrestrial. And in the abductions, yes, there are claims that of interaction with the beings, but those are completely contradictory all over the world. It's as if whatever is said is symbolic rather than factual. And I've never been able to find a pattern in those.
We're going to probably not take any more calls because we've only got about a minute or so left, Jacques, and you, Paul Smith. Paul, first of all, I want to thank you for coming on the program again as usual, my friend.
Oh, I'm always happy to be here. It's always a lot of fun.
We didn't get a lot of time to talk about dowsing, but we should one day because that's an incredible technique that people can use to harness all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know Ramon Grace, Paul?
I'm sorry, Ramon Grace? No.
Yeah, you don't. Okay, he's a dowser, and he's a darn good one. So
interesting. I'm always looking for folks like that. So
they're out there. Paul Smith, his latest book, by the way, Reading the Enemy's Mind. And you, Dr. Jacques Vallée, I want to thank you again for coming on the program and for coming out. It's been a long time for you, Jacques.
It's a pleasure being on your program, George.
Okay, my friend. Dr. Jacques Vallée, I've wanted to talk with him almost since the beginning of time. For Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Gina Salvati, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudetsur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.